Hello and welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and today's vegetable garden doesn't have to be big to give you all the produce you like to eat. Gardening small is the way to go, says author Kate Copsey, especially if you lead a busy life and have limited space. In The Downsized Veggie Garden, she shows you how to create a small, easy-to-manage, edible garden almost anywhere, outdoors, indoors, in containers, on balcony railings and windowsills, even going vertical. And I have with me on the line Kate Copsey. She's a freelance garden writer, radio show host, and author of the book, The Downsized Veggie Garden, How to Garden Small, Wherever You Live, Whatever Your Space. Kate, thanks for joining me today.
Oh, you are more than welcome. Yes, and it's beautiful over here in New Jersey. Yes.
And it's beautiful here in Logan, Utah. It's a little cloudy today, still spring weather, rain one day, sun the next, snow again. So it's that time of year, though, when we are thinking about what to plant. And so I'm curious, what prompted you to write this book? Because obviously you are a gardener extraordinaire. You've been gardening a long time. You know what you're doing. And so what prompted the book?
Well, one of our kids brought me the Square Foot Garden book. And as we were downsizing, we'd got four children, and I guess my husband wanted to downsize each time. And I'm not very good at doing that because I like gardening. And I guess I was in an apartment during relocation, and it started to make me think how people in those very small areas really did get on into gardening. So I proposed it to the editor, and he took me up on it. But the other thing that I found was that our eldest had just brought his first house with his wife, and it occurred to me that they were actually interested in doing small gardens as well. So it really goes to both ends of the spectrum. Those of us that are downsizing from kind of the acreage, and those just starting as well.
Sometimes you're forced into it, like you were when you moved into that apartment. But how do you know when it's time for you to downsize if you just stay in the same home?
Well, we did downsize just a little bit to this one in New Jersey, but yes, it's kind of a mental adjustment, I think, as well. But on the other hand, you know, when you've got a lot of acreage, it's a lot of hard work to do things in the ground. So, you know, when I went to the Square Foot Gardens and raised bed, it was just so much easier, I think, than, you know, digging up the back 40, which we did when we had a lot of acreage. So, yes, it was a lot simpler than I thought. So, yes, it was great fun. You know, you can sit on the side of the raised bed, and you can just pick out the weeds and then pick out the carrots. And, you know, it was much more pleasant than going down on your knees in something that's in the ground, because when we were in, I think it was Indiana, you know, we had a tractor and, you know, dug beds that way. And, you know, when you do it in the ground, it seems like it gets a lot more weeds to it.
Yes, so, doesn't it?
You know, yeah.
So is there anything that you've missed about downsizing?
Actually, right here, you know, it's been able to maybe grow quite as much. You know, when we had the kids, you know, we were feeding everybody from the garden. And I think as they go away, you know, I suddenly realized that the whole thing, you know, mowing the lawns and things like that, when you've got three flat acres, it's, you know, the teenagers disappear. And, you know, so that side of it was a lot easier as you downsize. But I think maybe it's the quantity that you get, and then you could have that little bit extra to can or freeze or something like that, which we never did when kids were with us. So, yes, it's a much smaller garden. So, you know, it's... I just enjoyed the smaller sizes when I actually got used to them. So
the positives way outweighed the any negatives.
Oh, I think so. Yes, because as I say, it takes a lot less time when you've got the raised beds, once you've got them started, apart from, you know, the original building of them. And actually, when we came to our current location, you know, the first thing I did was clear some land, put the raised beds in, and I ended up going to a wood merchant to get the boards for it. And, you know, actually building them was harder work than I thought. And actually I found, you know, when I guess 20 years ago, you know, you used to have kind of five yards of compost in the driveway. Mm-hmm. And then you just wheel it to the right place. And I'm finding now that that's a lot more hard work. It takes a lot longer than it used to. Well, 5 yards seems to take forever.
and you're talking as far as small as you can get, 16 square feet, that's 4x4. So you can do quite a small space.
Yes, yeah. Actually, my beds now are about 10 foot long, which was the most I could get into the car. But, you know, you have to make those adjustments. But one of the things I thought about the 4x4s, they're great for lettuce and things like that, and they're easy to cover. But the 10-foot ones I prefer for the what I call row crops, like the peas and the beans. You know, those never seem to be quite as successful for me in producing as much as I wanted to in just a 4x4. But lettuces and cabbages and tomatoes and things, those are great in the 4x4s. And then I just have this one bed that I use for what I would call, as I say, the row crops, and the carrots run down the side of it and the onions down the other side.
Well, now you have your book broken out into three sections, and the first one talks about finding space to grow vegetables wherever you live. So when you're in, say, an apartment where you've been before, what do you look for? How do you know you have enough light and space to be able to grow something?
I think basically, you know, if you see other people growing things on their decks and things like that, I think if you've got a general idea of, you know, where's north and south, you know, if you go in the afternoon, you will see the balcony will be bathed in sunlight. And that's the sort of thing that you want to look for. If you go in the afternoon and everywhere's nice and shady, which in the summer is nice, but that's not enough for tomatoes and peppers that you might want to grow. So look, go in the afternoon and you will see how much sunshine some of these apartments would get. And if the apartment balcony is on that side, you're in good shape.
So if you have a north-facing balcony, that's probably, I guess you could grow like impatiens or some flowers that like shade, but it would be kind of hard to grow vegetables.
Yes, I mean, some of the lettuces, particularly if you're in the south, some of the lettuces and mints and things like that, they will take afternoon shade if you need it. But I think things like tomatoes and peppers and beans and eggplants, all those kind of hot weather plants, they really do need to be bathed in sunshine all afternoon. If you just get kind of morning sun, some of the lettuces will do fine there, some of the kales, what I would call the early season ones. And mm-hmm. If you think of the early season, we don't get as much sunshine generally, and the angle of the sun is much shallower. So the actual heat getting onto the plants is much lower as well. So, you know, that comes into it. You know, so some of the lettuce will do quite well on the east side of a balcony or something like that. True north, where you don't get any sun, is going to be tricky. You're going to probably have to be inside and growing maybe hydroponically or something where you can add that extra light to it.
Well, I'm talking with Kate Copsey. She's author of The Downsized Veggie Garden, How to Garden Small Wherever You Live, Whatever Your Space. And if you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can also send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. So what are some of the places that maybe you wouldn't necessarily think where you could grow something. So we've talked about balconies in an apartment. So would you put like a whiskey barrel? That's kind of, you know, pretty good size to be able to grow something. What do you grow things in on an apartment balcony?
Well, actually, you know, that there are some new containers out that you can hang over the railings, which are very good. There are also some vertical systems that actually only take maybe 2 square foot on the ground, and then you have 5 pots going upright. The one that I like is called My Garden Post, and it's kind of a plastic post, and you have 5 different containers that can hang on that, and that you know, alleviates it so you can actually sit down at the same time. I mean, one of the things when you get into containers, particularly in small spaces, if you get hooked on it, then there's no space for you to sit down and actually enjoy the space yourself, because it's all over with the plants. So anything that can go up is a positive with that space.
So you're looking for things like the peas, like, and I guess you wouldn't want to try to grow corn on a balcony, but...
Well, there is something called an earth box, which is kind of an elongated type box that's on wheels, I believe. And that you can grow maybe a little bit of the peas and the beans. And the advantage with that, again, because they're going upright, that can give you some much needed privacy on a balcony as well. So it's kind of, and that would work in subdivisions you know, that type of place where, you know, you want just that little bit of privacy, maybe for your morning coffee or your evening cocktail, you know, where you've got the peas that give you the barrier, or the beans growing up. So sometimes, you know, a 2 foot or 4 foot balcony, you know, you could have that little bit of privacy on there, but anything that goes up relieves the space on the lateral ones. Things like squash, they have a tendency to run over the ground a little bit. So you know, rather than trip over those, you might want to stick to, say, anything that goes up is really good.
And I know in a lot of smaller yards, you don't have much in the back, but you do have some space in the front. And I think oftentimes people don't think, oh, I can't grow vegetables in my front yard, but actually that's a great location.
Oh, absolutely. But I think depending on where you are, I mean, those things called covenants might have problems with it. So you have to make it, I think, aesthetic as well as fundamentally edible. And, you know, things like blueberries are great to grow in the front. But also when you look at lettuce, I mean, you've got so many different shades and colors of lettuce. You've got green ones and light red ones and dark red ones, that you can actually use those as edging plants. Just as much as you can maybe the petunias. And then you've got okra. I mean, the flower on okra is absolutely fabulous, even if you don't like the fruit, you know.
Well, and you can even grow okra in Utah. I've grown okra in my garden here. The pods don't get as big as if you were growing them in the South, but they're sure great cut into the wagon wheel shape and rolled in cornmeal and fried. I like, they taste great.
Yes. And you know, they're a little bit like zucchini, in as much as they're underripe one day and overripe the next day.
Yes.
And they produce a lot of vegetable. So, yes, I mean, when you do use them, you know, they are great. But the flower is just spectacular.
So I wanted to talk about windowsills, because especially in older homes, you tend to have a windowsill that you can grow things on. What sorts of plants do well in a window box?
Well, you mean one that's just on the windowsill, on the inside or outside?
Yes. How about both?
Yes, I mean, on the inside, again, so long as it gets sufficient light, but windowsills particularly, you know, so long as you've got maybe 4 or 5 inches deep on the container, one of those long containers, certainly lettuces and kales would do great. But some of the small tomatoes might also work quite well in that. Tiny Tom, for instance, doesn't get too big. You wouldn't want to put maybe, if it's only a 3 foot container that's maybe 4 inches wide and 6 inches deep, you probably would only want one tomato in there because the roots of the tomato naturally on a garden bed would go down. When you've got it in a restricted one, they're going to go across. So you're going to limit the amount of other things that you can put in there. But certainly small tomatoes, if you've got light, lettuce, kales, the chards would do fine in that. And a lot of herbs would do well as
basil.
Well. Parsley and basils and things, they will do fine too.
I love this idea also I've seen in your book about rooftop gardening. You don't usually think about growing on your roof. And a lot of Utah homes don't have flat roofs because of the snow load. But if you have a flat area, that might be an area to consider. You've got this one couple growing on top of the garage, their garden.
Well, yes. I mean, and the thing that you have to remember, obviously, if you're doing a rooftop, whether it be an apartment block or a garage or wherever, they weren't made to hold big containers. So you have to think about the structural side of it, just as anything else. And the example that I've got in the book, he was just across the front where the garage doors were, because that's the main frame of the garage. And so there you've got the structural strength where you can put some containers. It's not right in the middle of the garage roof. Where you don't, you basically got wallboard, and you can imagine if you put kind of a couple of big containers, it's going to start bowing, and you'll end up with the tomatoes on top of the car, which you don't want. So a little bit of common sense as to recognizing where the strength on the rooftop is the first step. The other thing you have to consider is how are you going to water it? Dragging a hose pipe up or goodness, a watering can up. It's a bit of an issue sometimes. You know, I've heard of people that drag the watering can up the stairs to the apartment roof, and then they water, and then they do that about six times. So that to me means, you know, you've got something wrong in your organization. But the water inside. But then the positives are you get lots of sunshine. You're not going to have deer and groundhog and chipmunks eating it. So, you know, there are some positives to it. And it can look very attractive. Add a few flowers draping over the side. And you've got an attractive garden that everybody actually comments about as well. And so, I think with anything that you do in the front yard that's unusual, like the vegetables, people will stop and ask you about it when they're walking the dog or walking little children to school or, you know, just enjoying the evening.
Well, and everyone, well, it seems like most everyone has a parking strip that would actually do quite well for growing vegetables in, if that's all the space that you have and you have permission from either the city or the covenants from your particular place that you live, that's plenty of space to be able to grow vegetables.
Yes, I think so long as it's about a foot wide, I mean, that really is all you need. And then, you know, you just kind of go down the side between your driveway and the next driveway, whether it be in attractive containers or whether it be actually dug in that little piece down the side. You could do either one.
So if you've decided to do raised beds, you obviously have to put more a growing medium in there. So you have in your book a percentage of what you need of different items to create that growing medium. Why don't you address that?
Well, actually, that was based on Mel Bartholomew, the square foot gardening guy, which is one-third peat moss, one-third vermiculite or perlite, and one-third compost. Now, in the original one, he uses several different sorts of compost to get a variety of nutrients. I tend to go bulk compost, so I just fill it up with that. But you use the peat moss kind of adds a little bit of volume to the general bed. And the vermiculite or perlite, I prefer perlite personally, and they're kind of little, like little tiny popcorn things, and mm-hmm. that aids with aeration that you need, which if you use garden soil, you know, particularly in the Midwest, you've got a lot of clay. You probably have to compete with rocks and things in the garden as well. But in a lot of areas, I'm on sand right now, you know, you need that. The different soils tend to be a little more sticky. And, you know, that's why I think the raised beds make it a lot easier. I think one extension agent commented that there is no situation in the ground that cannot be corrected with a raised bed. So this mix I put in. But even if on my garden beds where I grow herbs and things, I still put a certain amount of peat moss in there as well as compost every year. Because I'm on sand, I don't need the vermiculite in the on the garden beds, but I still put in the peat moss and the compost. They're good for most areas.
Yes. I'm talking with Kate Copsey. She's author of The Downsized Veggie Garden. If you'd like to join our conversation, it's 1-800-826-1495. We have her for a few more minutes. 1-800-826-1495. Or you can send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. So with these created beds, how much fertilization do you need to do?
I think that compost generally is the best fertilization for any vegetables. And I certainly don't go for the chemical varieties. I like everything to be natural. When I'm putting things out, like peas, for instance, the first feeding, if you like, of that will be a compost tea, because that kind of just moistens the ground. I don't use any chemicals at all, because I think if you're growing vegetables, you like to know what's on them, and you know it would be contra to everything. You know, if you start putting chemicals on them, you might as well go buy the iceberg lettuce from the supermarket. Mm. What we want is to get the well-tasting lettuces and cabbages, and without them growing quite as fast as maybe the ones commercially. You know, so I think compost every spring is an essential part of the nutrient base. A little bit of maybe extra fertilizer for tomatoes, because they are heavy feeders. There are some organic tomato plant feeders. That would be fine to put on, or a general organic 10-10-10 or something like that, maybe just once in the season. If you're in containers, which are virtually a large raised bed type idea, and you're growing in containers, maybe every time that you change out, whether it be the tomatoes and cabbages, and you may be changing out to put maybe some tomatoes or peppers in, at that point I would take out the top maybe 4 or 5 inches of the container and refill that with some good compost and mix that in. So, you know, it's just really refreshing the top of the garden beds or the container just every time you turn it for another season.
We have our first caller, and it's Margaret in Vernal. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. This is a little bit off the subject, because I wanted to ask about cyclamens and how you get them to bloom again.
What was the flower?
A cyclamen or cyclamen.
Oh, okay. Cyclamen or cyclamen.
Yes, whichever you wish to call it.
Kate, do you feel like you could answer that question?
Well, the flowers, you know, like tomatoes and things, you know, they tend to go off, you know, they tend to, they flower fairly early in the season. Is that what the question was?
Well, she was wanting to know how to get the cyclamen to flower again.
I was given a cyclamen, and it had flowers on it, and the flowers have now died, and I was wondering what to do to get the next blooms, and when to expect them.
Most flowers in the veggie garden, you know, you can mix things like marigolds and things do well in gardens. And, you know, when the squash flowers start coming out, you know, they need lots of fertilizer. So anything to attract insects to the garden is good. The first pretty flowers that come out, I think, are the peas, which are early season, a little bit after chives put out their blossom. But I think if you put flowers in the vegetable garden, it's I think it does put in that those extra, it drags in the extra pollinators that you need.
Well, and Margaret, I'm thinking with your cyclamen, I know they don't like to be watered from the top down, and they prefer to have the water.
I've discovered that.
Yes. And so the one I have in my office, I just feed it about every third watering and water it from the bottom up, and it continues to go. Now, it does tend to like a little bit more light, so...
Yes, I've got it in a light place at the window, which gets the afternoon sun, basically, or late afternoon. But you feed it every quite often.
Yes.
With just a regular fertilizer.
Yes, I would.
Okay.
About every third time. Thanks, Margaret.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
I'm talking with Kate Copsey. She's the author of The Downsized Veggie Garden. So, Kate, if you had four things to tell people about what they should do in their veggie garden that would really help things go along, what would those four things be?
The first one would be don't crowd things, because we expect a lot from our garden, but just putting too many things in and putting things too close, crowding them out, really isn't a good thing, because they'll all be compromised that way, and that's not a way to be successful. Another thing is to know where your sunlight is coming from. Even the first year that I was actually in this property, I put the tomatoes out and I put the peppers on the wrong side. So as the tomatoes grow tall, the peppers are growing a little bit, but they were on the shady side. So they don't do as well. So make sure that you've got the tall plants at the back and the shorter plants in the front, so that they all get sufficient sunlight. And I think another thing that's important is pick the right variety. Get things that are maybe virus resistant, and made, if you're going in containers, make sure that they are labeled small enough for containers. The industry has responded beautifully to small varieties. You know, don't grow a dinosaur kale, for instance. Go for maybe a dwarf Scotch kale. So use be aware of kind of the names of these things to give an idea how much space they're going to do. You'll be a lot more successful with the smaller varieties. Let me see, that was three. And the last thing would be maybe to make it fun. Everybody kills things sometimes. Don't get over it. But to be successful, just have some fun with it. Enjoy growing things. Pay attention to it. Enjoy it. Maybe go around every morning or every evening. That way, the basic IBM type of idea of you catch the problems early and figure out what they are, and that way, again, you'll be more successful if you pay attention to the plants. And enjoy eating them. You know, don't put things in that you don't like. Except maybe a few.
Try something new.
I grow kale because chard, but my husband doesn't like them. But I like looking at them.
Yes.
So, you know.
Especially if you have something like bright lights that has all that fluorescent coloring. It's just really pretty.
Oh, yes. The reds and the yellows and the vibrant colors. Mm-hmm. They're beautiful.
Well, Kate, thank you very much for joining me.
You are very welcome. Thank you very much, Brian. I appreciate it.
Kate Copsey is the author of The Downsized Veggie Garden, How to Garden Small Wherever You Live, Whatever Your Space. And we'll have this interview archived on the Zesty Garden webpage at utahpublicradio.org. Thanks again, Kate.
Okay, thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye. In our gardening calendar, if you want to learn how to plant a garden that blooms all season long, Cache County Extension is holding a class tonight from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Cache County Building Multipurpose Room. You'll learn how to make your yard colorful all season using trees, shrubs, perennials, and annuals and ground covers. The class will also teach which plants work best for sunny, shady, dry, and other challenging locations. Child care will be provided. Registration information is at 752-6263. Learn proper pruning practices for shade trees in a workshop at the USU Brigham City campus. That's tomorrow from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. It's free, but pre-registration is required at extension.usu.edu/boxelder. The Cache County Master Gardeners are presenting their Gardening in a Challenging Climate lecture on Wednesday, April 6th at the Willow Park Zoo Wildlife Learning Center, 6 to 7 p.m. Rose Greach presents Monarchs and Butterfly Gardening Basics. Information is at bridgerlandaudubon.org. And then finally, next Thursday, March 31st from 5 to 6 p.m., Juab County Extension presents a Rose Care Pruning and Management class at the Memorial Rose Garden, 110 East, 100 North in Nephi. Bring hand pruners, loppers, gloves, and wear a long sleeve shirt or jacket. Information is at extension.usu.edu/Juab. Stay tuned. More is coming up. I'm in studio today with Jerry Goodspeed, who is USU's Horticulture Extension Agent, and it's our Wait, Wait, Don't Plant That segment. And the first one that I'm going to look at with Jerry is Cintranthus, also known as Jupiter's Beard. So, Jerry, why is this on your list of plants not to put in?
Well, it's kind of odd because it is a beautiful plant and it is dry. I mean, it can grow in a lot of dry locations. However, Jupiter's Beard is also very aggressive, and, you know, it likes friends around. And so if you plant it by itself, pretty soon you go out there in a year, and there's seven or eight friends, and pretty soon there's 20 friends, and pretty soon there's 400. And the other thing that this is what my wife pointed out. So I grew it for a little while, and my wife pointed out the problem with this stupid plant is you can't pull it out of the ground unless the ground has had about 17 inches of rain on it, because it has a deep root system and it's just really hard to pull. Other than that, it's really a nice plant.
Okay, so what keeps it in check? Because I'm thinking of one that I did plant like maybe 10 years ago, and after about 7 or 8 years, I noticed, okay, there were little plantlets all over the place, and maybe it was the weather for that winter happened to be really bad, because it didn't come back 1 year, and I thought, I'm going to leave this out. But I just put in another one in a really dry location that I don't like to water. Am I up the creek?
No, you're not.
Okay.
It's okay. And as I say, the good thing is it'll bloom all year. And maybe this is a good plant for people with brown thumbs, because, you know, you can just barely get it to survive, and so it's not going to get any offspring.
So what does it look like? When does it bloom?
It blooms almost all year. It'll bloom from, you know, May until September. And it's kind of an odd color. It's kind of the color of...
It's kind of like a mauve.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, see, that's what I'm going to call it.
If it's not just a red or a pink, then I'm kind of thrown off.
It's kind of in between.
Yeah. And that's kind of, and it has variability too. I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but it can't make up its mind. So it's red and then pink and then some color I can't explain, and then a kind of a salmon-y looking color, and a mauve, I guess, is a good description.
They're small flowers. I mean, it's like a cluster of a lot of small flowers. Yeah. Do you deadhead them to keep them blossoming?
I deadhead them right to the ground.
So you really don't care for this plant.
Oh, I can't say that. It does have its place. That place is usually somebody else's yard. But, you know, it's got a unique color to it, and it can be a little bit aggressive. Let's say that.
All right. So if you put it in an area where it doesn't get a lot of water, does it seem to do just fine and will continue to spread?
Yeah,
I'm
actually,
asking this
it does.
Because of personal. I'm like, I just put this in, so it's easy for me to take it up and put it somewhere else.
Yeah, actually, we have it planting at the Utah house where we don't water it at all, and it does quite well. And it tends to, as I say, in our situations there, and it is full sun there, it does tend to fill in those areas quite a bit. A little bit of shade, it's not going to bloom quite as much. It's not going to be quite as aggressive. Give it and it can do, as I say, it does fine without any water, but for it to do its best, it full sun and a little bit of water.
Where do you usually find, where does this grow in nature that's without any help from mankind?
I have no idea. That's a good question. the word that comes to mind probably isn't appropriate for radio. But and I don't know where it's native to.
And what attract are butterflies attracted
yeah,
to it?
Yeah, it is good for butterflies and bees. Yeah.
So if you've got an area that you just can't get anything to grow in, maybe that might be the area to put it in.
Yeah, I guess so that's a pretty good idea. You know, you get those wildflower mixes, and when they come with about 30 different wildflowers, and after 2 years, you're down to two. This would be one of the ones that would be left over that would still be blooming. So, yeah, you could put it into those areas where it can just go ahead and bloom and grow, and you don't have to maintain it much. But probably a great plant for that.
So why do they put it in these mixes? Just because they know it does grow so well, and they want to make sure that you see green and flowers the first year?
I don't know. I think because it's a cheap seed, if you really want my opinion.
Okay. Because you can find it everywhere.
Yeah, you can. It's just a cheap seed.
Okay.
And you know, a lot of that's just driven by finances.
So our wait, don't plant that plant for today is Jupiter's Beard, also known as Cintranthus. And you can find it at garden centers all over the place. But if you can, avoid it. But if you get swayed by the color, which is what I did when I bought this second plant, put it somewhere that you don't want everything else to be taken
away. Don't want it to overtake. That's
correct. Jerry, thanks for coming in. It's the Zesty Gardens Bug Bites segment, and I have with me in studio Diane Alston. She's USU's extension entomologist. And today's bite of information about insects is about the Mexican bean beetle. And I know I have them in my garden from time to time. Some summers they tend to be worse than others, but I don't usually worry too much about them because I tend to plant my beans so late that I've kind of missed the window.
And so what kinds of beans do you tend to find them on in your garden?
Blue Lake.
Okay,
so the stringless beans.
Right. So they love all kinds of green beans, and they like wax beans. And they'll even feed on other kinds of legumes too, but those first ones are their preferences. Have you ever used any just squishing methods where you feed?
Yes,
where you
could, if I'm picking the beans.
Yeah.
And I know to look for them. Now, they're usually on the underside of the leaf, so
right.
I have to be on the lookout. But if I start seeing them, then I'll start turning over other leaves to find them,
right.
and that seems to be well enough. If I have a really bad infestation, I use spinosad. I don't know if it's even registered for that, but
yeah,
they're biting mouth parts.
Right,
so
no, it works. Spinosad is a good product for them. Yeah, so the eggs are bright yellow in color, and they're laid in small clusters, so that makes them fairly easy to see when they're in the egg stage, which is an advantage if you want to try the, you know, looking and squishing method. But you mentioned that they are laid on, that you find them on the undersides of the leaves, and that's actually what this particular news article was about, is that researchers were looking for some non-insecticidal ways to help manage Mexican bean beetles, which are an invasive pest from Mexico and those types of areas, and have moved up into spread across the entire, you know, legume bean growing area of North America. And so they are.
And they even get into alfalfa?
Yeah, they said they can even feed. I don't think that's a favored legume, but they can. And they have now had problems with them in some areas in soybeans. So places in the country where we grow lots of soybeans, and in some places Mexican bean beetle have been problems there. Here in Utah, we know about them as a bean pest in our home garden or small scale bean production. But that point about that they like the undersides of the leaves was something that researchers took note of and said, we knew if we shined a light on a leaf, the bean beetle, the active stages, the larvae or the adults, would always crawl around and move to the opposite side if that was their only choice. It could be on the side with the light shining or the side away from the light. They always move to the other side, and they would only ever lay their eggs on the side that was away from the light. And so that gave them an idea with these types of plastic mulches, so the plastic covers that we put down on the ground to help accelerate the soil heat and get our plants growing faster. If you use a type of plastic mulch that has a metallic surface, and what that does is reflect the sunlight back up onto the underside of the plant. And so that's what they found, is that when you use a metallicized plastic mulch under your bean plants, that the bean beetles did not like those plants, and so they did not thrive there. They chose to go elsewhere. They, you know, you repelled them away from those plants, and they did not lay very many eggs and did not feed and cause very much damage to those plants.
I could imagine if you've got pole beans, so mine, well, my wife always has to step up on a stool to get to the ones at the very top because I'm using hog panels and horse panels stacked on top of each other. So, I mean, if I'm reaching up, so what is that, about 7 feet that they're up, that they wouldn't probably reflect that tall. But I could especially see this if you're growing bush beans.
Yes.
Wow, that would be a great way to control them.
Right. You're right. It may not, but maybe you could come up with some, maybe you could hang some of this metallicized plastic mulch on the wire or, you know, on the panel that you put up or somehow to, you know, on the edge or something, the side that would still reflect light back into the plant. And so it's not mentioned in this article, but I had read elsewhere, too, that they were looking to develop varieties of beans that had leaves that were just, you know, maybe smaller leaves or leaves that were at certain angle, grew at certain angles, such they didn't provide as much shading and that would just be more resistant to Mexican bean beetles because they wouldn't like those kinds of leaves as well.
Mm. I love this type of control that gets away from the chemicals.
Yeah.
Because doesn't it also make it harder for the insect to develop against that type of control? In other words, if you've got chemicals, well, there's always a few that aren't bothered by the chemicals, and eventually the population builds up and they're resistant to it. But it's harder to be resistant to something like this.
To something like a behavioral change, yes, for sure. I mean, insects are so prone to developing resistance to insecticides because, in general, insects are they live in a chemical-oriented world. They use odors, you know, chemical cues to find their food, to warn them of if there's a predator around, you know, pretty much to find a mate. You know, everything in their life is controlled by chemicals. And so they have biological systems that are very highly adapted to adapt to chemicals. And so if we spray a particular kind of insecticide like malathion year after year for a long period of time, pretty soon that insect says, well, I've developed a way now to detoxify that or somehow avoid that chemical in my physiological system. And so it's not a problem for me anymore. Mm. Whereas moving, you know, always trying to find the shaded underside of the leaf. And if you can't find a very good place, giving up and just flying away and saying, I'm not going to lay my eggs here is something that they're probably not going to adapt to very well.
And it's interesting that they are able to look at these limiting factors to insects. Mm-hmm. And they're going to vary from one insect
to the next
to another.
Right.
So maybe I should have gone into research to look at something like this because this just seems fascinating to me.
It does. Yeah, I thought it was a very, again, you know, it seems like a fairly basic kind of solution, a metallic plastic mulch, but how creative and how effective. It sounds like it can be very, very effective.
And this is the Mexican bean beetle is the one that they studied.
Right.
And so that's native to the highlands of Mexico.
Right, right.
So, but it has spread, I guess it's a lot more of a problem in the eastern and Midwest than it is here.
I think here it's common here, but it, as you were just describing, yeah, I see them in my garden, and you know, some years they're worse than others, or maybe it's a certain variety of bean that I grew that year that it's worse on than others. But
and maybe there are more predators here than there are.
But they don't see. I mean, we, you know, you lose some productivity to them, but it's not a tremendous amount. Whereas there have been times in the past and locations in the eastern United States that have had what you would call a real outbreak where they were unable to grow beans in that area with the populations of Mexican bean beetle they were experiencing. So much more severe, I agree with you, in the east. But here it's common, but kind of at a lower level.
And that's our bug bites segment for today. We were talking about the new control methods for Mexican bean beetle that are very IPM, integrated pest management friendly. And Diane Alston has been my guest. Thanks, Diane.
Yeah, thank you.
Good morning. This is Nancy Williams in for Petals and Prose. And today I'd like to read you from another essay from one of my favorite authors, from one of my favorite books. This is from Sue Hubbell's book, A Country Year. Sue Hubbell, you may remember from the past, is a 50-year-old ex-librarian and a beekeeper and a self-taught naturalist who lives by herself in the Missouri Ozarks and writes about them. So when I read about honey, I'm usually reading from her book, too. This is just about spring, and I'm kind of antsy for spring right now. You probably are, too. So she just begins her spring section with this essay. The river to the north of my place is claimed by the U.S. Park Service, and the creek to the south is under the protection of the Missouri State Conservation Department. So I am surrounded by government land. The deed to the property says my farm is 105 acres, but it's probably something more like 90. The land hasn't been surveyed since the mid-1800s, and it's hard to know where the boundaries are. A park ranger told me he suspected that the 19th century surveyor had run his lines from a tavern because the corners seemed to have been established by someone in his cups. The place is so beautiful that it nearly brought tears to my eyes the first time I saw it 12 years ago. I feel the same way today, so I have never much cared about the number of acres or where the boundary lines run or who exactly owns what. But the things that make it so beautiful and desirable to me have also convinced others that this is prime land, too, and belongs to them as well. At the moment, for instance, I am feeling a bit of an outsider, having discovered that I live in the middle of an indigo bunting ghetto. As ghettos go, it is a cheerful one in which to live, but it has forced me to think about property rights. Indigo buntings are small but emphatic birds. They believe that they own the place, and it's hard to ignore their claim. The male birds, brilliant, shimmering blue, perch on the garden posts or on top of the cedar trees that have taken over the pasture. From there, they survey their holdings and belt out their songs, complicated tangles of couplets that waken me first thing in the morning. They keep it up all day, even at noon, after the other birds have quieted. The indigo buntings have several important facts to tell us, especially about who's in charge around here. The dull brown sparrow-like females and juveniles are more interested in eating. They stay nearer the ground and search the low-growing shrubs and grasses for seeds and an occasional caterpillar, but even they know what's what. One day, walking back along the edge of the field, I came upon a young indigo bunting, preoccupied with song practice. He had not yet dared take as visible a perch as his father would have chosen, but there he was, clinging to a bare twig and softly running through his couplets, getting them all wrong and then going back over them so quietly that if I had not been within a few feet of him, I would not have heard. Another time I discovered that the back door of the honey house had blown open and the room was filled with a variety of winged creatures. Most were insects, but among them I found a half-grown indigo bunting who had blundered in and was trying to find his way out, beating his small wings against the screened window. Holding him carefully, I stroked the back of his neck to try to soothe him, but discovered that his heart was not beating in terror. Perhaps he was so young that he had not learned fear, but I prefer to think that, like the rest of his breed, he was simply too pert and too sure of his rights to be afraid. He eyed me crossly and tweaked my giant thumb with his beak to tell me that I was to let him go right this minute. I did so, of course, and I watched him fly off to all the tall grasses behind the honey house, where I knew that one family of indigo buntings had been nesting. Well, they think they own the place, and their assurance is only countered by a scrap of paper in my files. But there are other contenders, and perhaps I ought to try to take a census and judge claims before I grant them title. There are other birds who call this place theirs. Buzzards, who work the updrafts over the river and creek. Goldfinches, wild turkeys, phoebes, and whippoorwills. But it's a pair of cardinals who have ended up with the prize piece of real estate, the spot with the bird feeder. I have tapes of bird songs, and when I play them, I try to skip the one of the cardinal because the current resident goes into a frenzy of territorial song when he hears his rival. His otherwise lovely day is ruined. And what about the coyote? For a while, she was confident that this was her farm, especially the chicken part of it. She was so sure of herself that once she sauntered by in daylight and picked up the tough old rooster to take back to her pups. However, the dogs grew wise to her, and the next few times she returned to exercise her rights, they chased her off, explaining that this farm belonged to them and that the chicken flock was their responsibility. When I started thinking about it that way, that those who inhabit the land and use it have a real claim to it as in a non-legal sort of a way, the whole question gets complicated. A long time ago, before I came to live in the Ozarks, I spent a springtime working on a plot of university research land. I was young and in love, and most tasks seemed happy ones. But the project would have captured my fancy anyway. There were three contrasting habitats being studied: upland forest, bottomland, and sandy waste. My job was to dig up a cube of earth from each place every week, sift it, count, and rough classify the inhabitants visible to the naked eye, and then plot the population growth. The resulting curve, a joyous, vibrant freshening of life, matched the weather and my own pulse beat. That particular love has quieted, and I have not excavated cubes of earth on this place, but I know what is going on down there. Millions of little bodies are fiercely metabolizing and using the land. I dare not even think what numbers I would come up with if I added a pocket lens or microscope to my census-taking tools. But there are other residents I can count who do have arguable title here. There are 20 hives of bees back by the woodlot in my home bee yard, each hive containing some 60,000 bees. That makes 1,200,000 bees, their souls flitting about making claim to all the flowers within 2 miles. On the other hand, there are the copperheads, who make walking the fields a boot affair, and all of their snakish kin. How am I to count them and judge their claims? There are the turtles, who eat the strawberries in the garden, the peepers who own the pond. What about raccoon and skunk and deer rights? What about the bobcat, who denned in the cliff by the river and considers my place to be the nearest, merest sliver of her own? It begins to make me dizzy, even trying to think of taking a census of everybody who lives here, and all of them seem to have certain claims to the place that are every bit as good, and perhaps better, than mine. Up the road there's a human squabble going over some land less happily situated. Rather than lying between two environmentally benign government stake owners, that land and all that surrounds it is in private land. One owner wants to bulldoze and develop, and so the boundary question is becoming a sticky one. There is talk about having an expensive survey made to establish who owns what. As a spin-off, I suppose that corners will be set and lines will be run, and then I may know whether this farm is 105 acres or 90 or some other definity. The Indigo Buntings probably won't care. And that is Sue Hubbell's Country Year, and I am Nancy Williams. See you next time.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSR HD1 Logan, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.